From WHYY in Philadelphia, I'm Terry Gross with Fresh Air. On today's Fresh Air, the Book of Virtues. William Bennett was Secretary of Education under President Reagan, and he was President Bush's drug czar. Bennett's new best-selling book is a collection of stories intended to build moral values in children. We'll talk about everything from the Republican Party's direction to Bennett's blind date with Janis Joplin. Also today, we meet Ted Demme, director of the new dysfunctional comedy, The Ref. Demme worked at MTV for several years, where he created the hip-hop show Yo MTV Raps. And who gave the most boring speeches last night? David Bianculli reviews the Academy Awards. That's all coming up on Fresh Air. First, the news.
From National Public Radio News in Washington, I'm Corva Coleman. The Federal Reserve says it's raising short-term interest rates again. Policymakers at the nation's central bank made the announcement at a Washington meeting. The Fed raised short-term rates last month for the first time in 5 years. Fed Chairman Alan Greenspan says the increase will be small, but it's not known how much it will really be. A United Nations plane has landed in Tuzla Airport at northeast Bosnia. It's the first such flight in nearly 2 years. UN Special Envoy Yasushi Akashi, who accompanied the shipment, says this signifies the arrival of peace in Bosnia. But as Richard Carruthers reports from Tuzla, the Bosnian Serbs are still preventing any further relief from being flown in.
The Russian transport plane touched down with 22 tons of aid. UN envoy Akashi greeted the mayor of Tuzla with a box of vegetable seeds and said he hoped that, like these, seeds of peace and hope will grow. Tuzla Airport was closed in May 1992 after it was damaged by Serb shells. The arrival of this military plane does not mean a humanitarian airlift can begin yet for the more than 400,000 people trapped in the region. First, Serbs want to be allowed to inspect cargo, fearing Muslims could use the airport for gun running. While in Tuzla, Mr. Akashi visited a refugee camp. Children carrying flowers chanted, "We want to go home." The UN envoy said their humanitarian needs were dire and their living conditions almost subhuman. For National Public Radio, this is Richard Carruthers in Zagreb.
Senior House Democrats have agreed to discuss an appropriate timetable for hearings into the Whitewater matter. Pressure is growing in Congress to examine the affair. House Speaker Tom Foley says he and top Republicans will meet soon to talk about the details of the hearings, which Democrats have long resisted. House GOP leader Bob Michael says he is satisfied for the moment with the agreement. The entire House is expected to approve a resolution later today on the issue. Congressman Dan Rostenkowski may soon find out what federal investigators have in store for him. UPI's Jay Saper reports from Chicago.
The 2-year federal probe into Rostenkowski's finances seems to be winding down. The Sun-Times reports the Ways and Means chief's lawyers will soon be meeting with federal prosecutors. A grand jury has been probing Rostenkowski's role in the House Post Office stamps for cash scandal and questions about his payroll. The report suggests the meetings give defense lawyers a chance to make their final pitch before the grand jury decides on a possible indictment. Rostenkowski roared to a primary win last week, beating back questions about his ethics by stressing his 36-year track record in the district. Jay Saper, Chicago.
On Wall Street at this hour, the Dow Jones Industrials are up 5.5 points at 3,870. Trading is heavy on volume of 232 million shares. The Nasdaq is down a point at 796. This is NPR. The South African Transitional Governing Council has replaced the leader of another black homeland. The leader of CISGAI has been replaced by an administrator from the Transitional Council. The council acted for the second time to settle unrest in a black homeland. The first action was in Botswana, where the council acted to quell violence. But today's action came with the apparent cooperation of the CISGAI head of state. He'd requested help after striking CISGAI police took hostages. They were demanding early pension payments. Thousands of French high school students have taken to the streets for the fourth day in a row. They're protesting a government bill lowering salaries for graduates. Lynn Terry reports from Paris.
All the protests took place in the provinces. In Lyon, in southeastern France, students battled with police all afternoon. And in Chambéry, in the French Alps, protesters blocked the train station, while in Bordeaux, to the west, students let motorists go through a pay toll on the highway for free. In the past few days, dozens of people have been injured in the demonstrations. The education minister asked school teachers today to keep high school students in school, and the interior minister said parents should take better care of their children. These comments angered teachers' unions. One official said that rather than shifting the blame, it was up to the government to stop the strikes by withdrawing its bill. The measure allows companies to hire high school graduates on training contracts and pay them less than the minimum wage. For National Public Radio, this is Lynn Terry in Paris.
Secretary of State Warren Christopher says the dispute with North Korea over its nuclear sites is at a critical point. He's telling Congress the international community is ready to invoke sanctions against Pyongyang because the country has blocked inspectors from examining nuclear sites. Christopher says that other nations may even be willing to look at stronger measures if necessary. I'm Corva Coleman, NPR News in Washington.
This is Fresh Air. I'm Terry Gross. The former drug czar now has a book that's number two on the bestseller list. My guest is William Bennett. Under President Reagan, Bennett served as the chair of the National Endowment for the Humanities and Secretary of Education. President Bush appointed Bennett director of the Office of National Drug Control Policy. Now, along with Jack Kemp and Jean Kirkpatrick, Bennett co-directs Empower America, which promotes conservative ideas. Bennett's new bestseller is called The Book of Virtues. It's an anthology of what he describes as great moral stories dedicated to the time-honored task of the moral education of the young. He writes, "I know that some of these stories will strike contemporary sensibilities as too corny, but they will not seem so to the child." I asked Bennett if there were poems or stories he now loves which struck him as corny when he was young.
Yeah, well, a lot of these stories, I guess, growing up, struck me as corny. Some of the poems and some of the stories, I remember thinking these are pretty corny, some of the things I had to memorize. But later on, they took on some more significance. Little Boy Blue is something that was read to me as a child. I thought it was terribly corny. It still seems sort of corny to me, but as I read it now, I read it differently.
What does it say to you now?
Well, it's a very sad poem, and now that I'm a father of sons, I look at it a very different way. My sympathies were not with little boys when I was a little boy. And now I'm a father of little boys. My sympathies are with little boys. The second entry in the book is a story called Please. And I thought, well, this is just much too corny. You know, it's about a little word that lives in a little boy's mouth, and the word is please, and he gets tired because he doesn't get out very often, doesn't get any exercise. And I thought, well, this won't work with the modern ear, the modern sensibility, until I tried the story out with our four-year-old. And he loves the story, asks for it every night. Sometimes he even asks for it with a please. So that's encouraging. But, you know, you have to remind yourself that no matter what you think at 50 years old and rather, you know, a rough ride through the world or partly rough ride through the world, children at 3 or 4 or 5 or 6 haven't been there yet. And these things can make sense to them and not seem corny, where they may seem that way to you.
You were the drug czar, the head of the National Endowment for the Humanities, the Secretary of Education. Now you are a co-director of Empower America, and this is a private group that works in support of conservative values. How does a private group go about this work differently than, say, the Republican Party does when it holds the White House? In other words, how has the kind of thrust of your focus changed now that you're no longer in an official position in government, and now that your party isn't in the White House?
Well, it's different, for sure. We say, Jack Kemp and Jean Kirkpatrick and I, we're the co-directors, we say that we would aspire to be the loyal opposition, a kind of shadow government, or part of a shadow government. When you have been in Washington, in the government, in the administration for 9 years, as I was, in three different jobs, the first sense you get is that it's very different being out from being in. It's not all bad, by the way. I mean, I had time to write this book and some other books, too, and that's all right. Second, you can replenish intellectual capital, which I think is the single best thing I've been able to do the last 3 years. When you come into these jobs in Washington, if you bring any intellectual capital with you, you spend it during the time in government, because government is a flurry of activity. if you take your job seriously, if you travel around the country visiting schools or visiting, you know, areas of a lot of drug use, which is what I did in my last two jobs, you don't get a lot of time to read. So that's, I think, the first thing I've noticed being outside, be relieved from the daily pressures of being accountable as the head of a government agency. You know, not as many people call as call you when you're in charge. You can replenish, and that is someone like me who's trained as an academic. That's very, very important.
Speaking of reading, what have you been reading lately?
Well, I've been rereading my Walker Percy novels, which I haven't had a chance to do for some time. I've been reading a lot with my sons. We do a lot of reading from the Book of Virtues.
The Republican Party is regrouping before the next presidential campaign. How do you hope the party changes before the next presidential election?
Well, I would hope, as I said right after the election, in 92, I would hope the party has a political equivalent of a Council of Trent, that is a sense of coming together on doctrine, on principles, on ideas. I think we're in a position to refashion our philosophy. When you, this is another thing you asked earlier about being out of the White House.
Mm-hmm.
When it's not your president in there, in the sense of the person from your party. When your president, when someone from your party is the president, you pretty much have to follow that person's point of view, broadly speaking. It's hard to criticize the president when he's from your own party. When the person's not, you have an opportunity to shape your philosophy. And that's what we should be doing. I think we're doing it to some extent, though we should be doing better. The 94 elections are, of course, one important moment. We'll see what happens there. But I think on basic issues, crime, education, welfare, health care, the party should have a more distinct philosophy and point of view than it has at present.
Do you consider yourself a presidential prospect for the next presidential campaign or in the future?
I don't now. I don't now or I don't yet. People have encouraged me to think of myself in these terms. It's still very odd for me. I came at this kind of backwards. I tell the joke that the reason I got into politics was because Ronald Reagan was looking for a chairman of the National Endowment for the Humanities. And so he needed a conservative professor of the humanities, and they began a nationwide search to find a professor of the humanities who had voted for Ronald Reagan. And I was one of four or five people they found. That's a joke, but it's got a serious point to it. So I came in from the academy, and I've been in Washington since. Do I want to take the plunge into presidential politics? I don't know. I don't consider myself a candidate now. I don't know if I will in the future.
If you're just joining us, my guest is William Bennett, former head of the National Endowment of the Humanities, former Secretary of Education, and former drug czar. He's now a co-director of the conservative group Empower America. He's also the editor of the best-selling book, The Book of Virtues, A Treasury of Great Moral Stories. As someone who wants to instill values in the American public, do you think politicians, including the leaders of your party and the presidents under which you've served, have had some of their own problems in the virtue area?
Yeah, sure, absolutely. Yeah. Of course, yeah, both parties. Yeah, virtue is not distributed by party. I've written a number of times that I know good and honorable people on both sides of the aisle. As I said in the introduction to the Book of Virtues, this is not about politics. Virtue isn't about politics. Politics should be about virtue, I believe, more than it is. I can explain that in a minute if you'd like. But whether people are decent, reliable, honest, responsible, you really can't tell from the political labels. There are good and decent people on both sides, and there are knaves on both sides of the aisle.
Have you ever been disappointed in the behavior of presidents under which you've served?
No, not really, no.
Not even with Iran-Contra?
No, I don't think so, because although President Reagan came forward and admitted the problems, but no, I wasn't disappointed with that.
Sometimes two really virtuous instincts can come into conflict with each other.
Right.
For example, loyalty and honesty. Sometimes your loyalty to somebody conflicts with your obligation to be honest about something. And I wonder if in your years in public life you found that those two virtuous traits, loyalty and honesty, ever came into conflict in yourself, causing very difficult difficult thinking. Yeah,
not for me. I've been in some trouble. So some of your listeners would probably know that is some controversy. Been in lots of controversies, but been called lots of things. Have not been called. My integrity hasn't been questioned, or at least arguments haven't been made in any sustained way that I was dishonest. In fact, probably the criticism was that I was too blunt, too candid about things. No, I haven't had that problem. What you describe is traditionally in our literature has been a great occasion for some great writing. Hegel regards this as the definition of tragedy, two rights colliding, in this case, honesty and loyalty. And in the Book of Virtues, there are a number of stories along these lines. And it happens in politics.
You were a registered Democrat before joining the Reagan cabinet. Was there a turning point for you in going from Democrat to Republican?
Yeah, it was, early on, before I joined the cabinet. I grew up as a Democrat. I grew up in Brooklyn, New York, Irish Catholic. I didn't know any Republicans. When I got to college, I was a Democrat. I think that when I was in law school at Harvard in 1968, 69, my views toward the Democratic Party started to change, I think, with the turn of the party represented by George McGovern and others to the left. That's where I and many others felt uncomfortable. I was happy to be a Democrat because I always regarded myself as a Hubert Humphrey Democrat and thought that the Democratic Party would come back to that direction. When I joined the cabinet, Ronald Reagan knew I was a Democrat, and he'd been a Democrat too. I said, "Do I need to switch?" He said, "No, that's fine." There's an old tradition about having one person from the other party, one member of the cabinet from the other party in your cabinet. Many presidents have observed it. Reagan was happy to observe it, but I switched on my own voluntarily after a vote I watched on C-SPAN, in which the House voted against aid to the Contras. That was it. That was the last straw for me.
And why was that the turning point for you?
Well, I mean, it was building up. It wasn't the only issue, but it was just, I felt very strongly about this issue that the Contras were on the right side and the Sandinistas were not, that the Democratic Party here by a majority vote was not supporting, was supporting a repressive regime and not supporting a regime that would bring about the kind of revolution which we'd had in this country. So in total disappointment, told the president even if he'd like to have a Democrat, I couldn't stay a Democrat anymore.
My guest is William Bennett, former chair of the NEH, former secretary of education and drug czar. He's the editor of the bestseller The Book of Virtues, A Treasury of Great Moral Stories. More after this break. This is Fresh Air. Back with William Bennett. He now co-directs the conservative group Empower America. A couple of questions about your education as the former Secretary of Education. I believe you had a Catholic education, Jesuit and Benedictine high schools.
Mixed. I had public and Catholic. I was at a Benedictine high school my first year, but I switched to a Jesuit high school because the Benedictine high school, ironically enough, was had too much emphasis in the humanities, and I was interested in the sciences. Yeah, right. It's the way life turns out.
So what for you then seemed to be the pros and cons of going to Catholic schools?
Well, it was my mother's decision that we would go to Catholic school. It was not our decision. She wanted, as she said, good, strong, positive male role models, and she thought she'd get them in the Jesuits. And the Benedictines, and I think she did. She was concerned about that aspect of our development. This was not a negotiable issue from her point of view. I got very good education. I think Jesuit education is regarded by most people who've looked at it, sort of standard Jesuit high school education is very solid. Looking at it from a scholarly point of view, it is good. It's particularly good, and this is an area of great interest for me, in educating kids with disadvantaged backgrounds. Catholic schools and their record with inner city kids from disadvantaged backgrounds, disadvantaged Latino, African-American kids. It's extraordinarily good success record. The scholars think this has to do with the structure of these schools, that they provide a structure and a sense of aspiration within that structure that is very much needed for a lot of these kids. If you look at Chicago, if you look at New York, if you look at the track record of these schools with that part of the population, it's quite extraordinary. That's another reason I'm a supporter of educational choice.
You were on or around college campuses during very turbulent times from 1965 to 75.
Right.
Those years on college campuses had a radicalizing effect on many students. Did it have that effect on you?
Yeah. I was in Williams College, 61 to 65. Most of my friends were members of Students for Democratic Society. I was pretty liberal, maybe radicalized during those years, and remained so. One of my mentors was William Sloan Coffin, who became the famous anti-war protest leader out of Yale Divinity School.
Was there a turning point for you on campus where you went from the direction of becoming more radicalized to becoming more conservative?
Yeah, I think so. I think it was during the years at Harvard when I was in law school, during the years of some of the protests and riots and other things, when I saw that the criticism, what I thought was legitimate criticism of U.S. involvement in Vietnam, legitimate criticism in the sense that, you know, if we were going to send our troops there, Congress should declare war, we should do this in the right way, that Congress was sort of saving itself and sending our people over, that there was something wrong here. When I saw that a lot of that turned from that kind of principled opposition to what I called country bashing, America with a K, people starting to root for the Viet Cong, for the defeat of American soldiers, I said, "This is nuts. This is not the point of view I have." And then when I saw that a lot of the people involved in the protests and demonstrations were, to my mind, not acting out of principle at all, but something worse than that—tantrums, problems with their fathers, general dyspepsia.
You were a dorm proctor, but is that like an advisor?
Yeah, I was a resident advisor in the Harvard Yard in 69, 70, 70, 71, very hot years.
Let me ask you, there were so many people smoking marijuana in the dorms during those years. Was it part of your responsibility? Did you feel to, like, let the authorities know if you came across somebody who was smoking? How did you handle stuff like that?
No, I let my, we were urged not to do that.
Not to turn people in.
And we were urged not to, you know, go into rooms and, you know, grab people and turn them into the dean. And so I didn't do that. But I had very strong advice for my students, which was they should not blow their careers at Harvard by doping up. I had a group of freshmen who lived close to me who spent the entire afternoons, most weekdays, watching soap operas and toking up. And I didn't turn them into the authorities, but I would often talk to them and tell them this was a terrible waste. Two of them dropped out, never made it through. There was one incident when I was a proctor where I discovered, because one of my freshmen came to get me, several other freshmen who were selling drugs to kids, 12, 13-year-olds. And on that one, I certainly would have turned them in if had they not turned themselves in. I was so furious, they went and ran to the dean and turned themselves in, but I would have turned them in. My only mistake was I didn't turn them into Cambridge Criminal Court. These were babies they were selling drugs to, 10, 11, 12-year-old kids. And this was the drug culture at its worst.
One question about marijuana. What do you think about people who have inhaled and are running for office? Do you think that should be an issue, or do you think we should give that up?
Oh, I think it's been given up. I mean, during the time of Ginsburg, and I was involved in that, you may recall, I was the one who called President Reagan and said, look, you can't have a guy who smoked marijuana as a law professor with his students. Distinctions. People who said they smoked as undergraduates, as kids in the late 60s or 70s, there were so many people. I think most people don't think we should make a big fuss about that. But I thought that Judge Ginsburg, having done this when he was a professor of law with his students, that was the other side of the line. But I'm not interested that Al Gore smoked dope. I'm not interested that Bill Clinton inhaled or didn't inhale. I forget that.
If you don't mind my asking, I've read that you once had a blind date with Janis Joplin. So,
is this an FCC requirement that people have to ask me about Janis Joplin?
Does everybody ask you about this?
Yeah, sure.
Yeah. So, how did you get set up with her on a blind date?
I was very friendly with a group of undergraduates at the University of Texas. Again, I was a resident advisor there. And there was a group of them who were folk singers and rock and rollers. And they knew Janis Joplin. She was from Texas. And there was a jamboree one night in central Texas to celebrate the retirement of this wonderful old country singer. This man, Kenneth Threadgill, had given a start to Janis Joplin. So she came down to sing Bobby McGee. Under the stars in Texas on an August night, and she called her friends and said, give me a date. And I was about the same age, maybe a couple of years older, and so they asked me if I wanted a date with Janis Joplin. I was single, and I, sure, why not?
So you already knew who she was. She was already Janis Joplin.
Yeah, but this was pre-Bobby McGee. We heard Bobby McGee for the first time that night.
I see.
And so I felt very special that evening, but it was... she was very sad, I was studying philosophy. I was going for a PhD in philosophy, and she said, stay with it, your life is better. I thought my life was libraries and term papers, which essentially it was, and it struck me as interesting that she thought that was a lot better than what she was going through at the time. Sad.
Did you have a lot to talk about?
Yeah, we talked a lot. We talked a lot about music and talked a lot about, life. I was a philosopher and she was a singer. Well, that sounds like the beginning of a song, doesn't it?
Did you find her attractive?
She was so interesting. And so, she sang a 25-minute version of Bobby McGee. The place was just, everybody was in the palm of her hands.
So one last question. Do you think that you have become the person who you expected yourself to become when you were younger?
No. I thought... When I was a senior at Williams, one of my best friends did biographies of a whole circle of us. And at this age, at my age 50, he had me as chairman of the philosophy department at Wesleyan University. And I thought, wow, that'd be really great. And that's not where I am. I'm perfectly happy being where I am. More has happened to me than I expected. And I'm very pleased. And, the three jobs in government were a real surprise. But... I think nothing has pleased me more than this book, The Book of Virtues, and its reception. When you write a book and there's not a nasty or salacious or dirty thing in the book, and you're outselling Howard Stern and Roseanne together, I don't mean they're together, but both the sales of their books together, that's interesting and encouraging, and I'm pretty pleased about that.
Well, I thank you very much for talking with us.
Thank you very much.
William Bennett is the editor of The Book of Virtues. He co-directs the conservative group Empower America. I'm Terry Gross, and this is Fresh Air.
Busted flat in Baton Rouge, waiting for a train, and I was feeling near as faded as my jeans. Bobby thumbed a diesel down just before it rained, it rode us all the way to New Orleans. I pulled my harpoon and in my dirty red bandana, I was playing soft while Bobby sang the blues. Windshield wipers slapping time, I was holding Bobby's hand in mine. We sang every song that Javi knew. Another word for nothing left to lose. Nothing, I mean nothing, honey, if it ain't free. No, no. And feeling good was easy, love, when he sang the blues. You know, feeling good was good enough for me. Good enough for me and my Bobby, yeah.
Major funding for Fresh Air is provided by Borders, where the love of books and music sets the standard. This is NPR, National Public Radio.
From Philadelphia, I'm Terry Gross with Fresh Air. Coming up, we meet Ted Demme. He began his career at MTV, where he created the popular hip-hop show Yo MTV Raps. Now he's completed his second feature film, a comedy about a dysfunctional family called The Ref. It stars Judy Davis, Kevin Spacey, and Dennis Leary. Ted Demme was influenced by his uncle, Jonathan Demme, who directed Philadelphia and Silence of the Lambs. And TV critic David Bianculli decides who won and who lost in the speech-making category at last night's Academy Awards. That's all coming up on Fresh Air.
From National Public Radio News in Washington, I'm Corva Coleman. The House has voted to hold hearings on the Whitewater affair. The vote was 408-15. This follows agreement by leaders of both parties to negotiate a timetable for the hearings. It's also similar to a Senate resolution that was recently passed. Representative Jim Leach, who has spearheaded the call for hearings, says the hearings will be conducted with decency of temper. A senior State Department official has arrived in New Delhi for talks with Indian leaders. Relations between the United States and India are the lowest they've been in decades. NPR's Eric Weiner reports from New Delhi.
Large demonstrations were expected this week at the U.S. Embassy here as Assistant Secretary of State Robin Rafel arrives for talks with Indian officials. Rafel has been vilified almost daily in the Indian press ever since October when she questioned India's legal right to Kashmir, a mountainous region in the northern part of the country. More recently, President Clinton expressed concern about alleged human rights abuses in the region, but this week's talks will also focus on India's nuclear program. The U.S. has been pressuring India for years to sign a nuclear non-proliferation treaty, but defense officials here say they will continue with their program as long as neighboring Pakistan and China do the same. This week's talks will lay the groundwork for an upcoming meeting between President Clinton and Indian Prime Minister Narasimha Rao, expected to take place in Washington sometime in early May. This is Eric Weiner in New Delhi.
Talks between members of the European Union over the issue of enlarging their organization have failed to resolve a key dispute. NPR's Andy Bowers reports.
All of the EU's 12 current members say they welcome the admission of four new countries, Sweden, Norway, Finland, and Austria. But Britain and Spain are steadfastly opposing a change that would go along with expansion. They want to hold on to the current system of EU decision-making, in which three nations can band together to veto decisions made by the majority of members. Germany, Belgium, and others argue that expanding the EU's membership should also mean expanding the number of countries needed for a veto. Britain argues that it doesn't want to give up its national sovereignty to the Union, and British diplomats have so far resisted heavy pressure from their European partners to compromise. However, if the dispute goes on much longer, the four newcomers won't be able to join the EU by the target date of January 1st. I'm Andy Bowers in London.
The South African Transitional Governing Council has replaced the leader of another black homeland. The leader of CISCI has been replaced by an administrator from the Transitional Council. The government says the U.S. trade deficit got much worse in January. The Commerce Department says a big drop in aircraft sales and telecommunications equipment caused exports to fall by the largest amount on record. On Wall Street, stock prices ended the day slightly lower. The Dow fell almost 2.25 points to close at 3,862.55. Declines led advances in heavy trading. This is NPR. At a continuing inquest into the Hebron massacre, several Palestinian eyewitnesses today testified that a second gunman may have been involved in the slaughter. This contradicts the official Israeli army contention that just one gunman was involved. The BBC's John Devitt reports from Jerusalem.
Three witnesses said there was gunfire from at least two directions in the mosque. One, Muhammad al-Jabari, said he was sure that there was fire from more than one direction because the shooting continued even when Goldstein stopped to reload his gun. The evidence conflicts with the Israeli army's findings that there was only one gunman, but the judges questioned why some of today's testimony was at variance with the evidence the witnesses had given earlier to the Israeli police and human rights groups. In a number of cases, it was unclear whether echoes or ricocheting bullets may have created an impression that gunfire was coming from more than one direction.
The BBC's John Devitt. Meanwhile, there's word that Israeli PLO peace talks could begin again. Israel reportedly has tentatively agreed to let international peacekeepers into the occupied territories. That's been a key Palestinian demand for resuming peace talks. The chief Israeli negotiator confirms a deal has been concluded, but he won't say what it is. PLO and Israeli negotiators are supposed to meet tomorrow in Cairo to see if higher-level discussions should be held. The Senate has taken up the budget battle. The biggest dispute is over spending cuts worth $26 billion. They were part of President Clinton's long-range spending plans. A bipartisan group of pro-defense lawmakers is going to try and restore all or part of the cuts. There's little doubt the Senate will approve the basics of the budget by the end of the week. Mr. Clinton wants to spend $1.5 trillion for the year. This would also reduce the deficit to $175 billion. That is the lowest deficit amount in 6 years. I'm Corva Coleman, NPR, in Washington.
This is Fresh Air. The Ref is a new comedy about a dysfunctional family. My guest is the director, Ted Demme. He used to work at MTV, where he created the popular hip-hop show Yo MTV Raps. At MTV, he also directed spots with comic Dennis Leary. The Ref stars Leary as a burglar on the lam. He takes a married couple as his hostages so he can hide out in their house. What an awful place that turns out to be. The husband and wife, played by Kevin Spacey and Judy Davis, bicker constantly. And to make matters worse, it's Christmas Eve, and the extended dysfunctional family is coming to dinner. Here's Leary sizing up the home of his two neurotic captives.
Nice. You rich?
No. Oh, God, no.
Not really.
No.
Antiques like this ain't cheap.
Oh, I run an antique store in town. These are all from the
shop. It's his mother's store.
So?
Well, you made it sound like it was yours. You know, I run an antique store.
I did not. I said I run it. I didn't say I own it.
Oh, come on, Lloyd.
I am the manager of the place.
Do you think he cares if you work for your mother?
Let's get one thing straight, okay? From now on, the only person who yells is me. Why? Because I have a gun, okay? People with guns can do whatever they want. Married people without guns, for instance, you.
Mm-hmm.
Do not get to yell. Why? No guns. No guns, no yelling. See? Simple little equation.
Ted Demme, welcome to Fresh Air. The Ref is a comedy about constant bickering. Do you have a personal frame of reference for this?
Oh, boy. I hope my mother's not listening. I do. I think we all do. I mean, one of the things that we set out in the beginning of this film was there were two real topics about the Ref that I personally loved and was ready to throw big jabs at. One was the idea of dysfunctional families, which it seems that every family is dysfunctional in some sort. I mean, if it's not you, your sister, your mother, your father, it's, you know, grandma or your uncle or somebody. And the other thing was Christmas, that we just felt it has become such an outrageous, horrible, nightmarish occasion where people just lose their minds. So the thought of being able to poke fun at those two topics was great excitement to me.
You know, since your movie is set during Christmas, you would have thought it would have been a Christmas release, but it's not.
Well, you know, that's ultimately not up to me. It's up to the ghost of Walt Disney. But, you know, I think that once we found out that the film wasn't going to be released in Christmas, they wanted it earlier so they can capitalize on Dennis Leary's kind of excitement and stuff like that. And we made it more of a background piece than the primary plot. So I think it still works.
Now, Dennis Leary stars in the movie as the burglar who ends up fulfilling his worst nightmare when he holds these guys hostage. How did you start working with Dennis Leary on MTV?
When I first got out of college, I went right to MTV. It was really kind of my first job, and I ended up staying there almost 6-7 years. And right towards the end, I had gone and seen an off-Broadway play called No Cure for Cancer that Dennis was starring in as a one-man show. And I called him up the next day and said, hey, listen, we got to talk. And we sat down, and I said, I think that a lot of this stuff that you say in your show will translate great on MTV, and I could just visually see you, you know, really rapid fire, just delivering all these statements, bang, 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 bang. And we just took bits of the show and put them into 60-second spots, and then I would sit down with him and say, well, what do you think about racism? And then he'd just kind of start, you know, babbling away, and I'd write him down. And next thing you know, we did these spots, and that was really the first time we kind of worked together.
He's kind of like a rock insult comic.
He really is. It's true.
Let me play this spot that you did with him on censorship.
When it comes to the NEA, I can't say you and I can't say eat. But you know what I can say? You suck. The NEA and Tipper Gore want to censor radio and music and art and film and sculpture. Hey, censor this, okay? Don't preach to me about Jesus and the Bible. If Jesus was alive right now, he'd be listening to Ice Cube, okay? Two words, Mary Magdalene, sit down and shut up. The devil is not a rock or a rap musician. The devil is tall and white and has an unbelievably huge nose, and his name is Barry Manilow, okay? Judas Priest on trial because kids committed suicide. Let me get this straight. Heavy metal fans are buying heavy metal records, taking the records home, listening to the records, and then blowing their heads off with shotguns? Where's the problem? That's called an unemployment solution, folks. It's natural selection. It's the bottom of the food chain. Why don't Two Live Crew albums have a This Music Sucks label on it? Why isn't there a Shoot Me, I'm Old sticker on every piece of Don Henley's work? Huh? If it was up to Tipper Gore in the NEA, you know what you'd be watching on MTV right now? This. I think you hear me knocking, Tipper, and I think I'm coming in, and I got Ice-T, T-Monk, Miles Davis, Axl Rose, Elvis Presley, Keith Richards, Public Enemy, and a stack of Marshall amps with me.
Now, how did you work with Dennis Leary in developing a visual style for his verbal raps?
Well, I think that Dennis really dictated what the visual style was. I mean, the thing that I wanted to do was, I knew I wanted these spots to be very, very fast-paced and quick-cut because his delivery was so fast. So I thought the thing that would be great was to always have the camera moving. Let's always keep the camera moving. Let's keep Dennis moving. Let's always let the eye be assaulted by Dennis, where he's coming right at us, or he's going left to right, and have him always talking. And what I do is I just let the camera run and just have the cameraman go back and forth with him, and eventually we just end up jump-cutting a lot of the takes.
Well, the cuts happen real fast. There's a lot of cutting on these 60 seconds, on these short spots. And in a way, that's real MTV style, to keep the cuts coming at you.
Absolutely. I mean, MTV kind of created that fast-paced style. And so I just really knew in my heart that when I first saw his stuff, that it was a perfect medium for MTV.
My guest is Ted Demme. He directed the new film comedy, The Ref. More after this break. This is Fresh Air. Ted Demme is my guest. He directed the new comedy, The Ref. You created Yo MTV Raps, MTV's rap show. And until MTV got a rap show, MTV was accused in many ways of being an almost apartheid-type station because there was so little black music and rap on it. What gave you the idea of starting a rap show on MTV?
When Yo MTV Raps started to come about in my mind was when MTV started wanting to do more long-form programs. They had a few shows on the air like Club MTV and Remote Control that were half-hour shows that MTV really didn't have. They just had music videos at the time. So Peter Daugherty, who was my supervising producer at MTV, was also good friends with Rick Rubin and a few other guys in the rap industry at the time, and I just asked him to help me put a pilot together. And after a few times we got shot down, because they didn't think it was going to be accessible enough. Jazzy Jeff and the Fresh Prince came out with Parents Don't Understand. That was a real kind of poppy hit back then, back in 88, I guess. And MTV loved that clip. And then suddenly they were like, okay, why don't we see what this rap thing's all about? And they let me do a pilot. So I got Run DMC to be the host of the pilot. And we shot a real low-budget 60-minute pilot that did an enormous number ratings-wise. And we started with a half-hour show about 2 weeks later.
Describe the style you came up with for the program.
Well, the style that I wanted in the beginning was really just to expose the artists and put as many artists on the show as possible. We got Fab Five Freddy to be our first host, and he's really the biggest rap aficionado of all time. And what I wanted to do was keep the show on the street. So we never shot in a studio. We never shot indoors for the first year, and we always had a guest on the show. So it looked immediately different from any show that was already on MTV, because all the shows originated from a studio and just had a single host. So it was kind of cool in that sense that we looked different than MTV, other than the color of the host that were on our show, but also in the style.
Was it a self-conscious experience at all for you to be the white director of a predominantly black program?
Well, I guess yes and no, Terry. I think in the beginning I was certainly, you know, we'd go up to, you know, on Fab Show, we'd go into some pretty hairy neighborhoods as far as I was concerned, you know, being a white guy from Long Island. You know, we'd go up to the Bronx, we'd go up to Harlem and, you know, places that I had not been too frequent of a visitor to. So it was certainly a little, you know, scary in the beginning, but Fab was great, and Fab was always the guy that would bridge, you know, me to the people we were interviewing. And the success of the program over the first year, I mean, you got to remember the first year that we did Yo, groups like Public Enemy and Hammer and, you know, EPMD and all these, LL Cool J, these great rappers, this was the first time they're ever on TV. So, like, I was, like, the first guy that put them on TV in their minds.
You know, one thing I've noticed about rap videos is that so many of the rock videos for so many years were just had these surrealistic themes, and all the imagery would just be surrealism, the point of which I would often not get. And rap videos broke that trend. Rap videos aren't surrealistic.
It's true. Well, you know, for the first, like, 2 or 3 years of UMTV Raps, like, I guess 88 through 90, all the record companies would literally give each rap group, like, $20,000 to do their video, as opposed to the 40 or 50 that every rock and roll group would get. So, you know, like, what alternative do they have then to go out on the street and shoot the video? So, you know, most every rap video that was out in the beginning was shot in the street, shot like handheld, and they'd all put their homies in the background, and, you know, it would be a real, true performance video, and the stage was the street. So they were very real.
Ed Lover and Dr. Dre of UMTV Raps starred in your previous film, which was a rap comedy about the worst barbers in Harlem who become the unlikeliest cops in Harlem.
That's right.
And it was called Who's the Man? And why don't I just play the scene in which they're let go from the barbershop?
Okay.
For the last 6 months, all I've been getting is complaints about your haircuts. I asked you to straighten up. You haven't done it. You two are the worst barbers in Harlem.
What you trying to say, Nick?
I have to let you go.
Fine. Oh, come on, nigga. Ain't nothing happening. Nothing happening.
I'm serious. You boys have got to find careers for yourselves. I was just reading in the paper today, the police force is hiring brothers.
The police? Uh-uh, Nick, uh-uh. Ain't trying to be the man. Dre, you trying to be the man?
I am not trying to be the man.
See that, Nick? Dre don't want to be the man. I don't want to be the man. Nobody here wants to be the man, Nick.
Give me one reason.
Rodney King!
It's a job, boys.
That's too violent, Nick, man. We're not doing that.
You always watching karate movies.
Yo, man, those Bruce Lee movies are BS, man. But when you the man, people really shoot at you.
How did this movie come about?
This movie came about in a number of ways. I was kind of at the point of my MTV career where I started to feel like I had done just about everything I could have done at MTV. And Charlie Stettler, who was Dr. Dre and Ed Lover's manager at the time and also produced some Fat Boy movies and stuff, started to put a package deal together over at New Line, including me, to be the director. And at the same time, I had just finished a short film that I had directed, and New Line had used that kind of as their calling card to give me the opportunity to direct Who's the Man. And basically because the one big catch was that I said, listen, I can get about 50 rappers to come down for scale. You know, they're going to do me the favor to come down and be in this film. So that was, I think, the final straw that they said, all right, let's give him a few mil and let's see what happens. So it worked out that way.
What did you and what didn't you want to use from rap video style in your movie?
Well, I wanted Who's the Man to look like a movie. I didn't want it to look like a rap video, or a video for that matter. You know, so I wanted to also put some of the rappers in roles that they hadn't played previously in either their videos or in other movies. So the main thing I wanted to make Ed and Dre look like movie stars of some sort and give them, you know, real scenes with real dialogue and different angles and close-ups and all that stuff. I didn't want it to look like a video.
Have you ever directed videos yourself?
Yes.
Which ones did you direct?
I did probably not the best videos of all time. I did Salt and Pepper's first 2 or 3 videos. I did their first video that was called Push It. And a few other ones after that. I did a Kid and Play video. I became very good friends early on with Salt, Peppa, and Kid and Play. And then actually recently I did a video with my Uncle Jonathan for the Bruce Springsteen clip of Philadelphia that was from the movie Philadelphia. That was a lot of fun.
Now, Jonathan Demme, the director of such films as Philadelphia, Silence of the Lambs, Married to the Mob, he's your uncle, yes?
Yes.
Yes. Were you close to him?
Yes, still was and still am. He's been like a big brother to me for many years. He's my dad's brother. And, you know, growing up, he was my Uncle John. And then once I got a job at MTV, I think he thought it was really kind of cool that his younger kind of brother was working at this hip rock and roll channel because he's a big music fan, this and that. And at that point, we started to become a little closer. And he became a little bit more than an uncle. He kind of became a manager slash agent slash confidant. /uncle. Yeah.
When you were getting a job at MTV, did it help you at all to have the last name Demme?
Well, you know, who knows? You know, maybe subconsciously in whoever hired me at the time, I don't think so because it was at such a low level. When I first started trying to get a job in the industry, I purposely didn't go to Jonathan and ask him for a job, and I think he appreciated that because, you know, that's just always an awkward thing. I really wanted to go out and get something on my own, so... You know, who knows? I'm sure it didn't hurt, certainly, but I'd like to think that it wasn't the reason I got the job.
Was it thrilling to you when your uncle became a well-known director? Before you started working in movies yourself, you know, most of us don't have family in the entertainment industry, and it all seems very foreign to you when you're growing up.
Right. Well, you know, Terry, the thing is, when I was growing up, Jonathan's movies were always very kind of underground and cultish as mm-hmm. opposed to big box office smashes. And it made him even cooler in my eyes because he was such a really kind of, you know, somehow or another when you grow up, your uncles or your aunts always become, you always want to go hang out with them a little bit more than you do your parents because you can do things with them that you can't do with your parents, you know. So I always like loved to hang out with Jonathan anyway. I thought he was just a great guy. And then when he started making films and I could go onto one of his sets and stuff, I just really was totally blown away by it and just thought like the cool factor as a kid, you know, just
right.
Basically on the cool factor was very high and didn't even know if what I wanted to do, you know, then just knew that I loved being around the stuff he was doing. And quite honestly, it wasn't like I was around him 24 hours a day. But once I started to get a career, it became a little more real for me in terms of not just he's like the cool uncle that, you know, that I just love to hang with, but wow, this guy's a really great film director and he's my uncle, you know, and it's really exciting.
Ted Demme directed the new film comedy, The Ref. This is Fresh Air. Let's check in with Robert Siegel and see what's coming up on All Things Considered. Hi, Robert.
Hello, Terry. News today that the House of Representatives is moving closer to hearings on Whitewater. Also that the Federal Reserve is moving to increase short-term interest rates. And Sylvia Poggioli reports today on her visit to Mostar, a city in Bosnia, which, like Sarajevo, has been under siege, in this case for 10 months. However, she says that what 60,000 Bosnian Muslims in Mostar endured under Bosnian-Croatian shelling is worse than anything she's seen in Sarajevo.
Thanks, Robert. That and more on All Things Considered from National Public Radio. Last night, an estimated 1 billion people watched the ABC telecast of the 66th Annual Academy Awards. TV critic David Bianculli was one of them.
Let's start right off with the big story of the night. Bigger than Steven Spielberg finally getting his Oscar, bigger than Tom Hanks making an emotional speech about gay tolerance and AIDS. I'm referring, of course, to this question. Just how awful was Whoopi Goldberg? It was her first year hosting the Oscars, and probably her last. I tried keeping track of her 5 funniest lines, but when the show was over more than 3 hours later, I only had 3. And none of them made me laugh as hard as the acceptance speech by a sound effects editor, who thanked his family, quote, for knowing that I'm not usually this wooden, unquote. When your Oscar host isn't as funny as a sound effects technician, something, or someone, is wrong. One of the things we watch the Oscars for year after year is to catch our stars with their scripts down. We want to see emotion. Unfortunately, all the award shows these days are so worried about running overtime, they push winners to and from the podium as fast as possible, But when the biggest categories of the night came up, things finally slowed down. Like when Tom Hanks won Best Actor for Philadelphia, the story of a lawyer with AIDS fighting against the discrimination of his peers.
I know that my work in this case is magnified by the fact that the streets of heaven are too crowded with angels. We know their names. They number 1,000 for each one of the red ribbons that we wear here tonight. They finally rest in the warm embrace of the gracious creator of us all, a healing embrace that cools their fevers, that clears their skin, and allows their eyes to see the simple, self-evident, common sense truth that is made manifest by the benevolent creator of us all and was written down on paper by wise men, tolerant men, in the city of Philadelphia 200 years ago. God bless you all. God have mercy on us all, and God bless America.
That was a good, strong Oscar moment. Then came Whoopi.
As I'm standing here and I'm looking at all of you and I listen to Tom, I just got to tell you, I'm really glad we do what we do, man. We are amazing. So I just...
Not always. At least Whoopi didn't say anything embarrassing after Spielberg's first acceptance speech as best director for Schindler's List. He was allowed to talk a lot longer than 30 seconds, and viewers got a lot more drama as a result, all the way to the end of his speech.
And my mom, who's here, who is my lucky charm, whom I love very, very much. And to the 6 million who can't be watching this among the 1 billion watching this telecast tonight. Thank you.
I liked Neil Young's performance as much as I hated the one by Dolly Parton and James Ingram, which was a lot. But even with Young and Bruce Springsteen performing, and loads of glitzy stars presenting, and Paul Newman and Tom Cruise hugging, last night's Oscars were a big bore until those final speeches. And Billy Crystal, by not showing up this year, showed just how good a host he was last year, and the year before that, and the year before that. Look for him, or someone else, in 1995.
David Bianculli is TV critic for the New York Daily News. Fresh Air's interviews and reviews are produced by Amy Sallet, Phyllis Myers, Naomi Person, and Nancy Greenlease, with Peter Clowney and Kathy Wolfe. Research assistance from Louisa Shafia. Sue Spolin directed today's show. I'm Terry Gross.
Support for Fresh Air comes from the listeners of WHYY in Philadelphia, where Fresh Air is produced. This is NPR, National Public Radio.
As you prepare your tax returns, do you suspect that you're being taxed at a higher rate than a lot of millionaires? You're probably right, according to a new book by Pulitzer Prize-winning journalists Donald Bartlett and James Steele. On the next Fresh Air, we talk about their new book, America, Who Really Pays the Taxes? I'm Terry Gross. I hope you'll join us for the next Fresh Air.